Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host a Courthouse Steps oral argument on Catholic Charities Bureau v. Wisconsin Labor and Industry Review Commission, featuring Eric Rossbach. Eric is Vice President and Senior Counsel at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, where he has served since 2003. He has briefed over 90 cases at the United States Supreme Court and played a part in several major victories for religious liberties, including Hosanna Tabor, Hobby Lobby, Holt v. Hobbs, and more. In 2020, Eric argued Our Lady of Guadalupe School v. Morrissey Beru, earning a 7-2 win for his Catholic school clients. Eric has also represented clients in federal appeals courts and state Supreme Courts across the nation, as well as internationally in the highest courts of several other countries. Our moderator today is the Honorable Ryan Nelson. Judge Nelson was confirmed to the Ninth Circuit in October 2018 as the youngest circuit judge to serve from Idaho. Prior to his confirmation, Judge Nelson served for 9 years as general counsel for a consumer goods company in Idaho. He has also served in all three branches of the federal government, including as special counsel for Supreme Court nominations to the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, deputy general counsel to the White House Office of Management and Budget, deputy assistant attorney general in the Environment and Natural Resources Division of the Department of Justice, and a law clerk to Judge Henderson of the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Judge Nelson, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, and thank you to everyone for joining. And Eric, we're glad to have you here today to talk about your argument earlier this week before the United States Supreme Court and Catholic Charities Bureau versus Wisconsin Labor and Industry Review Commission. You've argued other cases in the Supreme Court, and all on behalf of the Beckett Fund. And I wondered, one of the prior cases that was mentioned was Morrissey Beru, and maybe it would be interesting for you to sort of talk about what overlap you saw between the Morrissey Beru case, which you previously argued and won 7-2, and this case that you just argued this week.
Sure. Do we want to give the background on this case?
Yeah. First? Why don't you start out with some background on this case, and then cover how some of the other issues overlapped. Yeah.
How the overlap worked. Yeah. So this case that we had on Monday involves my client Catholic Charities. They have been around in the Diocese of Superior in far northern Wisconsin since 1917, and they have a variety of different ministries to the needy, including the elderly, the people that need housing, disabled, developmentally disabled people, helping them to get jobs, and the hungry, among others. And they're spread out over this very large area of rural northern Wisconsin, and they're set up as the charitable arm of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Superior, Wisconsin. There's a lot of different sub-entities. So the Diocese of Superior completely controls all of these entities, including Catholic Charities, which is sort of the umbrella organization, and then there's different ones that might help just the developmentally disabled, or might have like a housing development for people that need housing, et cetera. And in Wisconsin, like many other states, there's a unemployment compensation system for people who have recently become unemployed. They can apply to the state to receive unemployment benefits, to kind of tide them over until they find a new job. There's an exemption within that for religious organizations. Specifically, there's one for churches. So that's, if you're a church, you can enjoy this part of this religious exemption. There's another part of it that says if you're a religious organization that's controlled by a church and you are, quote, operated primarily for religious purposes, then you can also be exempt. And since about 1999, Catholic Charities and its sub-entities have been trying to get that second part of the exemption applied to them so that they can participate in the Catholic bishops' own unemployment compensation program, which we think is better than the state's program. This case is really about whether this tax exemption applies, this religious tax exemption. And so I have not personally been litigating it since 1999. I was still in law school. The case has been going on. The various cases have been going on about this since that time. And in this particular instance, the case started in 2016 with respect to Catholic Charities itself, plus four of its sub-entities. The case sort of flip-flopped back and forth. So some of the lower courts said, we do get the exemption, then they got overruled. And eventually we got through to the Wisconsin.
And these are state courts in Wisconsin.
Correct. But also even before that, you had to sort of have an administrative hearing before the Labor and Industry Review Commission, which administers, so it's sort of the equivalent of the IRS, except for Wisconsin unemployment taxes. And so then we got to the Court of Appeals in Wisconsin, lost there. And then we appealed it to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which ruled 4-3 for Wisconsin and against my clients, Catholic Charities. So then we sought certiorari at the United States Supreme Court, and they granted that, and we heard, it's been briefed, and then we heard the arguments on Monday. Maybe I'll just go over briefly, like, sort of what the different positions of the parties were at the court. So we made three arguments under the First Amendment, and specifically under the religion clauses. Both religion clauses, so that's the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. And we had three sort of theories, if you will, underneath the religion clauses. One is the doctrine of church autonomy, because the weird thing that happened with this setup that they have in Wisconsin is that there's another sub-entity of Catholic Charities that was denoted to be exempt, called Challenge Center, and the diocese itself is exempt as a church. So you have essentially all these parts of the Diocese of Superior, Wisconsin, and there's a resulting patchwork of exemptions. So some entities within that are exempt, some of them are not.
Were the employees distinct, or were there some employees that crossed over between entities that made it even more complicated?
Well, actually, I think they all actually show up as on Catholic Charities payroll. So,
I see.
So they're really, it's operated as one operation. They do have separately incorporated subsidiaries, in part because, some of the places are over 150 miles away from Superior. And in particular, there's a doctrine within the Catholic Church called subsidiarity, which says you need to sort of try to get decision-making power put down to the lowest level possible within the church. So you're trying not to have everything decided at the upper echelons all the time, but instead, and so that makes a lot of sense when you've got, somebody in Rhineland or Wisconsin trying to make a decision about something. They don't want to have to go back and keep asking Superior, what do I do now? I don't have any power to do this. Could you please do this for me? So that's been a longstanding doctrine of the way that the polity of the Catholic Church is set up.
You mentioned that you had three arguments. You talked about church autonomy. What were the other two?
So the other two were, we had an argument about entanglement. So this is entanglement between church and state, and that the way that Wisconsin, administers this program, and the way that the Wisconsin Supreme Court decided to exclude our clients was entangling. And maybe I should just say a quick word about what the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled. The Wisconsin Supreme Court said that you don't, that uh, what Catholic Charities does is secular in nature. So it said that these are not religious activities because for a few different reasons. One is that what they what other people do. So the fact that there's other secular organizations that do the same thing, they said, means that this is not inherently religious. So it's a secular in nature. So even though they are, you know, handing someone a cup of water in the name of Christ, that's considered not to be a religious act because other people can hand out cups of water too. But then the other factor that they looked at was their religious practices. And they said, well, these religious practices aren't really on our list of things that we think of as religious practices. And specifically, they said, because Catholic Charities ministers to both Catholics and non-Catholics, so not just then that was a problem. So that, you know, basically penalized them for ministering to non-Catholics. And then second, Catholic Charities hires non-Catholics to do, you know, some of their work with people. That was also seen as a strike against them. And then another strike against them was that Catholic Charities doesn't proselytize, which means that they, you know, when they give the benefit, the aid or whatever, food from the soup kitchen or what have you to the person in need, they don't say, you know, first you have to come to Mass with me, or first you have to, you know, say this prayer with me or something like that. And so that was, that's called proselytizing.
And that's that's basically what the Wisconsin, that's what the majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court relied on.
They said that those were all strikes against them. So that if they had been doing those things, then they might've qualified for the exemption. So going back to our entanglement point, we say that that's very entangling because you're basically having the government grading how churchy or how religious somebody is based on specific theological positions. Now, within the Catholic Church, it's against Catholic teaching to serve only Catholics, and it's also against Catholic teaching to proselytize in the sense of you know, forcing someone to, you know, kind of coercing someone using the aid that you're trying to give them to attend a religious service or something like that. Those things are, you know, the worldwide Catholic Church says that is not allowed. So that's the second item, is entanglement. You know, you're sort of getting the two things entangled, and that the courts and the taxing authorities would have to sort of assess people, you know, whether they're truly religious. The third point is discrimination among religions. And we said, you know, based the rule that you've set up here means that entities that serve only their own co-religionists or entities that only proselytize are treated better than religious entities that don't. And we said that that violates a couple of cases. One under the Establishment Clause, Larson against Valente from 1982, and then another under the Free Exercise Clause from 1993 called Church of the Lukumi Babalu. And so we said this is a strict violation of both religion clauses, and we all of our three claims are couched under both religion clauses. And we pointed out that the court has recently really kind of repudiated an earlier thought process about the religion clauses where they were seen as in conflict, and instead they're now seen as complementary. And that's sort of very obvious in some of the ministerial exception cases where the court has really said that, but also the Coach Kennedy case about the football coach praying on the field. They also said these are not supposed to be, you know, they're part of a single sentence. They're drafted by the same people. You know, they're not supposed to be sort of two railroad cars bumping into each other all the time. They are actually supposed to be complementary and driving towards the same ends. And so we said that with respect to all three of those theories that we had. So, you know, below in the lower courts, Wisconsin had just made all these arguments about, well, these are purely secular activities. They kept saying purely secular. And they really tried hard in all the briefing to say, you know, you're just not in the list of, you know, you're not doing prayer. You know, you're not preaching, you're just helping people. And that's not religious. So that was their argument all below. They kind of changed their argument at the Supreme Court. And they said, well, yes, we do think that there's this list, but we're just doing the kind of line drawing that courts and legislatures have to do all the time when it comes to religious exemptions. And, you know, we actually, you know, we didn't say anything about it in the lower courts, but we have this really strong interest in not entangling church and state. And so we think this is the best way to not entangle church and state, is to limit the exemption to only entities that are preaching or praying or, you know, doing ceremonies. And, you know, everything else should be not be within the exemption. And that's less entangling. So that was their kind of argument at the Supreme Court. And they specifically invoked the ministerial exception that you had adverted to earlier in their briefing. The other really important brief to know about in the case was the Solicitor General's brief. So the Solicitor General showed up in the case. They filed a brief on our side of the case, but they had a little bit of a twist because they said, well, under a doctrine called stemming from a case called Michigan against Long, that the federal statute, the relevant federal statute here, the Federal Unemployment Tax Act, and the Wisconsin state law that the Wisconsin Supreme Court applied are so intertwined that the Supreme Court would be able to decide this as a statutory issue. So even though the Wisconsin Supreme Court was applying Wisconsin state law, which normally the United States Supreme Court would never, you know, rule on, the Solicitor General said, well, you can reach this issue because these two statutes are intertwined. And Michigan against Long says that then you can decide statutory issues. Now, that's usually that comes up in the context of something called independent and adequate state grounds. That's really what the Michigan against Long, that's not really the issue here. So this would have been an extension of Michigan against Long if they went there. However, they said we also win under the Constitution. So if you don't buy the statutory argument, the Solicitor General says, then you could go to the constitutional question. And they thought that it should be decided in favor of Catholic Charities. I just mentioned that because it's important, and the Solicitor General also, the Deputy Solicitor General argued the case as well on our side. So
just as background, sure. Maybe it would be interesting. Did you have conversations with the Solicitor General before the argument, or at least with the Deputy Solicitor General, about kind of how the case would be argued, or were your positions on two different tracks?
So no, what usually happens in these cases is that if the Solicitor General identifies a case as very important, they will meet with both sides of the case invariably, and then they will decide which side they want to come in on. Now, of course, they may have some idea which side they want to come in on. It was an interesting time for us because it was in between two administrations. So, you know, I don't have any idea what kind of discussions went on within the government, but that's it is an interesting fact that we, you know, they met with people at the beginning of January. So it was after the election, but before the inauguration. Then, you know, when you do it often, you might, you know, for example, attend each other's moots or things like that. But of course, I can't, certainly as the party, I cannot control anything that the federal government says in the case. And it's very typical for them to ask for 10 minutes of argument time, and they rarely have that denied by the United States Supreme Court. And of course, we appreciate having the federal government come in on our side of the case. So then, you know, at the argument itself, it was a very interesting argument. I would say, you know, I went first because I was the petitioner, and I think that the justices were all really very engaged. They clearly had dug into the case quite a bit, and were a lot of what they were doing was probing sort of the outer bounds of the arguments. And so, you know, how far does the rule go that you're suggesting, which is very typical for United States Supreme Court arguments.
Were you surprised? Did you feel well prepared, or were you surprised by some of the questions that came out?
Mostly I knew the questions that would probably be, you know, the kind of class of questions that would be coming, but there were a few things that we discussed that were not necessarily ones that I expected. So for example, Justice Alito did ask me, what's the difference between evangelization and proselytization within Catholic teaching. And I can say that that was not something that came up in any of my moots. I happen to know the answer, but it was not a question I was prepared for, but I think was useful just because proselytization is kind of a term of art, if you will, within Catholic teaching. So I would say, you know, there was also some questions about, I had a colloquy with Justice Barrett about how do courts define religion, which I don't think is a question that the court has to decide this case, but it is sort of lurking in the background. You know, how do civil courts decide what is religious or not religious? Now, of course, 99.9% of the time when these cases come up, there's no issue about that. Like you don't need any special knowledge to decide that Temple Beth Shalom is a religious Jewish synagogue, or that the Catholic Church in Philadelphia might be a religious entity. That's not something that comes up in most cases. Sincerity is something that comes up a fair bit, particularly in cases involving prisoner religious liberty litigation. And I think it's, again, though, I don't think courts actually have a really hard time with that. One can always imagine edge cases where it's a little harder to figure out, is this person sincere or not? But for institutions, sincerity really doesn't come up except when you have like a sort of a sham case, like a church of cannabis type of situation where.
So I wanted to ask about that because as you mentioned, a lot of their probing questions were on where's the limit here. And one of your answers was sincerity of religious belief is one of the limits. And how have courts got into that? I mean, do you find that to be a real limit in some of these cases where courts have said you just don't have a sincere religious belief? And how do courts do that without entangling themselves in the religious discussion itself?
Well, it's a great question. And I think it works well because it does, again, it comes up a lot in the context of prisoner litigation, but also, for example, religious conscientious objectors to military service and things like that, where you definitely have to look up sincerity. And the rule that the Supreme Court has laid out in a case called Seeger is that, courts can't decide whether a religious belief is true, but they can decide whether it's truly held. And the reason is because it's a state of mind question. Is this person really telling me the truth about what they believe? I'm not going to decide whether, who's Jesus or, what's his theological role or anything like that. But I can know based on, how people act that, their state of mind is, I believe in this. So there's actually a great case on this that Justice Gorsuch referred to at oral argument called Quaintance, United States against Quaintance, where there was basically some people who were distributing marijuana in this was when he was on the Tenth Circuit, I should mention, and they were distributing marijuana, and they would hand out to each of their drug runners a photocopied certificate that they were a member of the Church of Cognizance, and that distributing marijuana was part of the beliefs of this Church of Cognizance. And Justice Gorsuch, then Judge Gorsuch, wrote a really great opinion that sort of talked about how no rational jury could decide that this was sincere based on all the facts that were before the court. And so I think courts can decide these sincerity questions, and they do on a fairly regular basis. I think some judges get nervous about it because they're like, oh, I don't want to question someone's religious beliefs. But I think if they hold to that line of true versus truly held, it turns out not to be so hard. For example, it really matters, like, are there some sort of ulterior motives? So,
in the prison context, that comes up a lot. They're trying to get benefits sometimes. And I guess that could be a factor.
Yes. Oh, for sure. I mean, there's a very famous case called the Church of the New Song, which think about the acronym of that church, but it was a new church that was founded by a prisoner. And he said that the sacrament of the church was that that needed to be celebrated every evening was to dine on filet mignon and sherry. And and the court didn't have any problem saying that that doesn't seem like a great thing. And especially since the acronym of the church was CONS, the court didn't really have a lot of trouble saying that was not sincere. So I do think that those things are manageable questions.
And so that's why so this wasn't a paper tiger. You say this really did put some limit. I mean, when the Supreme Court was asking you where the limits are, this is a real limit that has some impact on the how broad the exception would be read.
That's exactly right. I think sincerity is really inherent to almost every kind of religion claim. You know, it's even if it's not stated aloud, it's read in by courts because, you know, unlike speech where you're really focused more on the external, you know, sort of marketplace of ideas and you can have a parody or something like that that gets covered, in the context of religious beliefs, you actually care whether the person, you know, there's a connection to their inner conscience, right? Because they're making a conscience claim. So I think it's a really great, I think it works really well in the lower courts. Now, of course, when it gets to the US Supreme Court, often things are, you know, you're like, oh, well, what about these sort of edge cases or hypotheticals that I can imagine? But I think 99% of the time, that inquiry about sincerity, and then another one that we said is a limit, which is, you know, religious versus philosophical, works pretty well. So there's also a colloquy at oral argument about what's the difference between religious and philosophical. And
the Henry David Thoreau comment. Yeah.
Yes, right. Exactly. And that was the discussion. I mean, that was the example that the Yoder court used. So the United States Supreme Court in a case called, actually another Wisconsin case, Wisconsin against Yoder, talked about, look, Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau, the famous philosopher, had very strong feelings about things and principled beliefs, but they were philosophical.
They weren't religious.
They weren't religious. And so it didn't enjoy the protections of the religion clauses. So in our view, those two sort of restrictions, you know, when properly applied, can really, you know, make clear that you're just limiting it to the people who really need the exemption.
There's a question I thought might fit in here that someone sent in. They wanted to know why entanglement is still discussed in First Amendment cases for those of us who just think of lemon when we hear the word entanglement.
Sure. So, yes, absolutely. So in the rule against entanglement actually predates the Lemon test. So the Lemon test, you know, if you read the Lemon decision, what they say is, well, we can't know anything, you know, from the original. So it's sort of an anti-originalist opinion. It says, you know, we can't really look back in history. It's too murky and hard to figure out. So we're just going to look over the past 27 years of our jurisprudence and decide, you know, glean is the verb they use, glean some principles from that. And so one of the ones that they gleaned is entanglement. Now, so entanglement came up actually in a case called Waltz against Tax Commission of the City of New York. And it went to whether having a tax exemption at all was too entangling. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's not too entangling. You know, I think sometimes people from a religious background might be very negative about entanglement as a doctrine, because it often got used to say, oh, well, these people have to be out of public life. You know, you can't participate because you're religious. But, you know, the doctrine has really changed and the jurisprudence has really changed under the religion clauses in the past 20 years, so that, you know, it actually tends to be a protection for religious organizations from having, you know, state entities come in and sort of check what you're doing. And that was one thing that came up actually in the Wisconsin lawyer's argument, where Justice Gorsuch, I think it was saying, well, do we need to send in inspectors to the soup kitchens to make sure that people are saying prayers before they get their soup at this one in order to figure that out. And isn't that horribly entangling? So I do think that that's kind of where the entanglement doctrine is right now. The Lemon Test, though, is completely gone now. It's been abrogated by the Supreme Court. Maybe I should just...
Some might say.
Some might say, well, that's true. So so my one, I think there's a lot of the outer bounds thing, and then some of these things like that got a little more philosophical, like what is religion? But I think, you know, and I might have added the point that I just said, I wish I had added the point that like sincerity and religiosity work really well across all these things, but you have so little time at these arguments, and like all of a sudden the light is coming on in front of you and you're done with your argument. But the, you know, religiosity and sincerity, I think, are very good and workable standards that the lower courts use, and they work well. The Solicitor General's argument, or Deputy Solicitor General Curtis Gannon, argued for the United States, and I thought he did a great job. You know, obviously he was talking about some of the same constitutional issues, but they were also talking with him about the federal government's suggestion that it get decided as a statutory matter. You know, we had said we were worried about a do-over in that situation. You send it back to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. They reissue the opinion, but just say, we're not relying at all on federal law here. We're just applying Wisconsin law. And then you're back in the same position in 2 years. I think he got pressed a little bit on some of that. And I, you know, just again, from a, you know, completely non-neutral standpoint, I didn't see a whole lot of interest in the court on taking them up on that suggestion. So we'll see what happens, obviously. And we were very clear, we'll take a win on any basis, because that's our job. And
yeah, no, I want to get to that. But before we jump into that, what I guess one thing worth noting, as I understand it, the Wisconsin exemption tracks federal law. Is that correct?
That's right. Yes.
And so did that play a role? I mean, was that more helpful in getting the Solicitor General involved in this case? It didn't matter. They would have gotten involved anyway because there were still federal constitutional issues. What role did that play, do you think, in this?
Well, certainly that is something where if they feel it's going to affect, even if it's not directly related, but it's going to affect some federal law, then that's absolutely an interest that the Solicitor General will pursue. Now, I'm not privy to whatever, you know, internal discussions they had, but I have to imagine that was part of it. But they also will typically show up in cases involving Bill of Rights, you know, anything in the Bill of Rights, because it's just so important. And of course, it affects the federal government, right? The scope of the Bill of Rights really affects the federal government.
And maybe that's important because there was a question that came in about, well, how can the Supreme Court decide or change the state Supreme Court's final authoritative interpretation of state law? But that's not really what you were arguing. You were arguing, as I understand it, that interpretation was a violation of the federal constitution. Is that right?
Exactly.
Right?
And that was our question presented, is does the Wisconsin Supreme Court's interpretation of this statute violate the religion clauses. So we didn't raise the statutory issue at all. We had argued it in below. So when we were in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, you know, we said this doesn't, you know, this is the wrong interpretation of the Wisconsin statute. But then once we got to the United States Supreme Court, we felt like they're not going to have the ability to deal with the Wisconsin statute or its interpretation. It's now been definitively interpreted by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. What the federal government's position does is sort of suggest that they could claw back a little bit of it because the two statutes are intertwined. And if they're completely intertwined, you know, there's some cases that say, well, if it's completely intertwined and you feel the state Supreme Court felt bound by the federal statutes, you know, strictures, then the U.S. Supreme Court can sort of decide the issue because you're really deciding an issue of federal law. But that's not, you know, I didn't take the court's questioning to seem like they were going to go that way. So, you know, we obviously think that the Wisconsin Supreme Court got both the statute and the Constitution wrong, but we only presented constitutional issues to the court.
So I wanted to kind of go back to this Morrissey Beirut, because, you know, just to walk through the ministerial exception, we had a 9-0 decision in Hosanna-Tabor recognizing the ministerial exception. Morrissey Beirut comes in and sort of doesn't have that unanimity. There's now a 7-2. It's a little harder case, I think you would say. Now we get this case up. Do you see this as more of kind of an, from the Supreme Court's perspective, is it more the easy case of Hosanna-Tabor, or do you think this might be split in outcome like Morrissey Beirut? And the reason I ask that is Justice Kagan, I thought, asked a pretty telling question where she said, look, there's probably some pretty tough issues here, but she sort of hinted it. This isn't one of them. And so I wonder if, you know, I know it's dangerous to extrapolate from questions at oral argument, but I wonder if you have a flavor of where this might end up.
Right. So, I mean, absolutely at oral argument, I think a wide spectrum of the perceived spectrum of the court, conservative to more liberal. I think people were all kind of questioning Wisconsin pretty vigorously. So, the Deputy Solicitor General for Wisconsin, I think he was trying to defend a tough decision to defend and was, able and civil about that, but it was a tough decision to defend. And they were, kind of going after it in a couple of different ways. One is that they were talking about the discrimination point and saying, this is discriminatory, but they're also talking about like the sort of second guessing of religious beliefs. I thought that where they were also talking about the church autonomy piece, which is directly related to the ministerial exception, and talking about, Justice Kagan said, make sure I get this quoted right. She said, this outcome sort of, what Wisconsin's arguing puts a lot of pressure on a church's organizational choices. And then later she was saying, this is extremely pressured choice because there's like the incentives, the power to tax is the power to destroy, right? So if you sort of impose a tax on having a particular kind of church polity, and there was a really great brief, amicus brief by 11 major religious denominations, including the Catholic Church, Baptists, LDS Church, a lot of different, I think Orthodox Union was on there, of Jewish Orthodox denomination. And they said, you really shouldn't, the non-discrimination principle should go to different kinds of church government too, because there's so many different kinds of church government. There's a wide variety of them. And I thought that was a pretty good argument in that brief. So you could see the court coming back with a decision that says something like, if they rule in my favor, and again, I don't want to be presumptuous, but just the overall tenor, and certainly the reports, the news reports seem to all see it that way. But they could come back with an opinion that says something like, look, you can't draw distinctions like this along theological lines. So you can't say like, you have a belief in proselytization, you're okay. You don't have a belief in proselytization, you're out. But also, you can't discriminate in a way that among different church governments in a way that sort of puts pressure on how churches organize themselves. Because if the Diocese of Superior just sort of, merged all of its different subsidiary entities into one big blob, they would all be exempt because it's a church. And so it would qualify under that first thing. And so sort of having a more complex polity, religious polity, was kind of used against them in this situation. So I could see the court coming back with that, because that sort of shows how our three different arguments are almost a little bit intertwined. They're kind of related to each other. And it really goes about, ultimately, and this is something I tried to emphasize at least at the end of my argument, which is like, we live in a very religiously pluralistic society. And that means we need to have room in our laws for that kind of diversity among religious organizations, because really every religion in the world exists somewhere in the United States. And so I think, having that kind of, more generous approach to these religious exemptions, they're not required to have the religious exemptions in the first place, necessarily, but once they do, they really need to be even-handed about how they how they approach them. You know, actually, one thing that did come up, you know, there are a few questions I got about, you know, what about profit versus nonprofit? Or what about the vegan restaurant that may be run by, let's say, a Hindu group or something like that versus, you know, what do you do about that? Or hospitals versus schools? And our view is, you know, a statute that just says, well, hospitals are not subject to this particular exemption is probably fine constitutionally, because you're not discriminating along religious grounds. You're discriminating amongst, you know, different kinds of entities. And you can see why a government might have an interest in regulating hospitals a little differently than, say, schools or, you know, houses of worship. What we were saying is, like, within that exemption that already exists, the religious exemption, you say, you know, you're operated primarily for religious purposes, you can't then start, you know, weeding out the sheep from the goats based on religious opinions and religious beliefs. So I hope that I got that across to the court, but that was the one part I was, you know, you always go back to think about the argument and you think, gosh, you know, should I have said this or should I have said that? So anyway, well, I think if they do something like that, it could really resolve a lot of these questions that have been, you know, an issue in the lower courts and really help a lot.
As we discussed, you'd argued the ministerial exception case in Morrissey Beirut. Obviously, you spent a lot of time preparing for that. You get a positive outcome in that case. How did that set up your framework for preparing for and arguing this case? Do you think it, you know, fine-tuned your arguments? Were there certain arguments you didn't make because of what you'd argued previously in your experience in Morrissey Beirut?
So not really. I wasn't thinking of this as like a follow-on to it. You know, it's not really a ministerial exception case because it's about, are these entities religious or not? You know, are they doing religious stuff or not? Are they operated for religious purposes? Versus ministerial exception is really looking within the organization saying, is this important? What is this person's role within the organization? Are they the leader? Are they teaching church doctrine, those kinds of things. So it's like a more contextual and relational analysis. So they're really kind of very, to me, at least, they're apples and oranges. So
were you surprised when the Supreme Court justices, a couple of them seemed to sort of draw some analogies from the ministerial exception. Were you surprised at that?
Not by argument. So the part that surprised me was in the red brief, the respondents brief. Suddenly they're like, oh, they're sort of wrapping themselves in the mantle of the you know, ministerial exception, saying, well, Wisconsin's just doing exactly what, you know, what this court did in Our Lady of Guadalupe or in Hosanna Tabor. So they were sort of using it as their shield or primary analogy. And so I think I told one of my colleagues, I thought, you know, wow, I didn't think I would be doing another case about the ministerial exception, because we also handled Hosanna Tabor. I didn't argue that one, but Professor Laycock did. But it was, you know, I've been closely involved with ministerial exception litigation for years, and I just didn't think of this case as a ministerial exception case, but somehow it just still kind of came out and got there. So, but I do think, you know, the church autonomy idea is one that really did get crystallized a little more in the Our Lady of Guadalupe case. And so I do think that there's a lot of discussion and thought, especially among scholars and within the lower courts, about both the ministerial exception as sort of a specific instance of church autonomy, but also the church autonomy doctrine more broadly. So obviously, you know, I don't want to put you on the spot, but you've had a couple of interesting cases since Our Lady of Guadalupe about, you know, the ministerial exception and how does it apply to different kinds of organizations, you know, and, you know, does it apply to a non house of worship like Orthodox Union, you know, which puts the circle U on food and says this is kosher or not? You know, does it apply to, you know, a novice Zen monk? Like, that's a pretty interesting question. So I think it's, you know, there's still a lot to be thought about and explored in the area of church autonomy.
Well, you have these three theories and you sort of talked about how the Supreme Court could go. I mean, obviously you said the right thing. You'll win on anything. You represent a client, you know, the good lawyer wants to win on anything. But as you think about, you know, taking a step back in the religion clauses more generally, is there one of these issues between the discrimination point, the church autonomy point, and the entanglement that you think would an opinion from the Supreme Court would be more beneficial?
I actually think the autonomy argument, if they did decide it on that basis, and especially this idea of like discriminating among different kinds of religious polities and sort of this language that Justice Kagan was talking about and Justice Gorsuch was talking about, I do think that that ruling on that basis might actually obviate a lot of cases in the lower courts where these distinctions come up. And if you end up like creating this big incentive structure for different church polities, you know, that can cause a lot that can cause a lot of problems. And I think that I actually think that you know, in terms of like what would maybe advance the ball or sort of resolve the most kind of cases at one swoop, that might be the one to do. Now, you know, I think a lot of the justices really got the no discrimination among religions point. And I think both Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kagan both said it was fundamental. So, you know, a fundamental feature of our religion clause's jurisprudence. And so that may be the route that they go. Obviously, you know, I think we went on independently on each of our three grounds, but you've heard that a lot over the years. And usually courts are going to decide it on one ground or another. So,
you know, was there any concern? I mean, could Wisconsin respond by what's Wisconsin's interest here? I mean, obviously, I guess they sort of are trying to control their state fisc. Are they providing unemployment benefits for Catholic Charity employees at the end of the day?
Well, they don't provide it themselves. What happens is that if you're in a non-exempt organization, so a regular employer, you know, let's say you're working at the gas station or what have you, your employer pays into the state, you know, fund. There's an unemployment compensation fund. They pay into that and they sort of have an account there. So if they have a lot of employees that they let go, their account, you know, they're paying out, the state pays out the benefits. So it's almost like the state is like a little bit of a trustee in the relationship, but it's not really kicking in its own money that much. And that's part of why we want to move over to the church program, because we can sort of be in solidarity.
You can control it, sort of like a private, you know, in the Social Security context, privatized Social Security as opposed to, well, I guess it's a little different because they're not individual funds, but.
Yeah, it's more, I would say it's a little bit more like a pension fund or something like that, where there's something you set aside.
Well, so under that, if that's how it works, then Wisconsin's interest is actually less important, or are they viewing it more as we have a duty to these employees? I mean, this goes back to what you were saying before. You believe that the pension or the unemployment fund that you were providing privately for your employees or Catholic Charities was more beneficial than the Wisconsin plan. Did that matter, though? I mean, what if you had said, no, we're not going to provide unemployment benefit? Would you have been less entitled to these exemptions?
No, it's a great question. The answer is no, we would be as equally as entitled, even if we didn't have it. Now, we view it as our duty to help our former workers, you know, that got let go or got sick or what have you, to help them out. So that is the Catholic Church's position. And it really makes Wisconsin's position in this case not really that logical, at least as applied to my clients. But as you say, there could be other people out there where there's a problem. Now, we, you know, one of the bottom side amicus briefs said, oh, well, it's 0.6% of people work at religious organizations and out of all workers in Wisconsin. And of course, maybe half of those are already churches that are already exempt, which, you know, Wisconsin is not really complaining about or worrying about. So, You're really talking
about...
It's
a very small group, in your opinion, that's actually getting the benefit of this exemption.
Right. And so the people that would potentially, you know, this, you know, it's a speculation, but it would be people who were working at one of these, working at an organization that was not Catholic. So it's not on the Catholic program. It's exempt and they don't provide any other sort of protection and they then become unemployed. So you're probably talking about a pretty small number of people that... you know, Wisconsin, it was really Wisconsin's duty to put that evidence in the record and they didn't, because it's their strict scrutiny defense. And I think they knew it wasn't a very strong defense because there's also a lot of other exemptions for, like, you know, people who deliver newspapers and things like that, that don't, they don't get this benefit either. So that's why I think they completely switched horses at the U.S. Supreme Court and said, well, our interest isn't in not entangling, but of course, you know, and we're going to, you know, we're worried about individuals maybe getting fired because they did something against the church. But it doesn't really make any sense if you think about it very long, because that it's equally applicable to all the entities that are already exempt, like churches or synagogues, et cetera. Plus, there's lots of people that work at these places that there wouldn't be any entanglement. So it doesn't, their sort of anti-entanglement interest doesn't really match up with what the way the statute's designed. And of course, I think it's highly unlikely that the Wisconsin legislature in 1972 was thinking about that a whole lot. So
do you anticipate, I mean, maybe you've sort of covered this, the stakes ultimately aren't that high for Wisconsin here. Do you anticipate that they would go back and try and make any amendments to either, you know, maybe take away some of the exemptions so that, you know, they maybe there's a way that they could bring in Catholic charities? Or do you think that they're tired of this fight? It lasted long enough and they're just ready to move on.
Well, I certainly hope that they would not try to change anything. I don't think that there would be any prospect of that in the near term, though, because the Wisconsin legislature filed an amicus brief supporting us in this case and said, we don't agree with the way that the Unemployment Commission has interpreted this. And we think that, you know, this is the better reading of our statute. And, you know,
well, and they I presumably said we don't agree with how the Wisconsin Supreme Court rule.
They didn't agree with the statutory interpretation. They didn't agree with the way the Constitution applied. And I saw one question here about Wisconsin Constitution's own religion guarantees. The Wisconsin Supreme Court, we did have that claim in there. The Wisconsin Supreme Court kind of just glided around it in a footnote and said, because we had said it's, you know, very similar arguments for both federal and Wisconsin Constitution. And they said, well, you didn't really develop it as a separate argument, so we're not going to address it. But I think the Wisconsin legislature was concerned about the Wisconsin Constitution and how that applied in this situation. So it didn't, the Wisconsin Constitution wasn't before the United States Supreme Court at all.
So. When you get into the line drawing, which again, everything was, seemed like there were a lot of questions at oral argument about that. Wisconsin, I think you would agree, could distinguish between religious and non-religious groups and provide an exemption only to religious ones. Is there, and this goes to your discrimination point, can it distinguish between religious groups in any way, or any distinguishing between religious groups would just be a violation of the Constitution?
No. And so this is something that we also, and I hope I got this across at oral argument, but I think it's very important. You know, what we said is there's a problem when you're discriminating along theological grounds, right? So it's based on, you have a particular practice, you help both co-religionists and non-co-religious. Now, Wisconsin ran completely away from that at the oral argument and said it's all about proselytization. So they kind of put all their chips on proselytization. But you know, we think either of them, you're looking at a theological belief, right? A belief, you know, is this the right thing to do as a Catholic? You know, is this moral to do this? And that really shouldn't make any difference to a court. And so that's why we said, you know, you've got an existing religious exemption. You can't just, you know, you didn't have to create it necessarily in the first place, right? So the Constitution doesn't say you must have a religious exemption in this case, but once you have the religious exemption, you have to sort of distribute it even-handedly and among different religious groups. Now, there is a corollary to that, I would say, and I think the U.S. Supreme Court has pointed out, which is that you can have specific religious accommodations that are designed to alleviate burdens, specific burdens on religious exercise. So, for example, providing a kosher meal for a prisoner in a state prison, just because you give the one prisoner a kosher accommodation, give them a kosher diet, doesn't mean it goes to all the other prisoners too, right? There's not a rule that you have to package it with the same kind of benefit for everybody else. And that's not considered discrimination. And there's been a couple of cases about that. One is the Amos case involving the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and a janitor. And then also another case written by Justice Ginsburg called Cutter against Wilkinson, where there was a challenge to the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act as violating the Establishment Clause. And that was a unanimous decision where the court said, no, that doesn't violate it. And, you can have specific accommodations for specific people. That's not discriminatory. That's just recognizing the fact that your rule is creating extra burdens for particular people. So if you force a non-religious prisoner or a prisoner, a Baptist prisoner to eat pork or something like that, that's not a problem for them. But that's the only option on the menu. But if you if that's the only option for a Jewish or Muslim prisoner who's devout, that is a problem for them. So you're alleviating specific burdens. The court has said that's not discriminatory.
And then maybe you already addressed this in the answer you just gave, but one other question that was submitted: if Wisconsin's compelling state interest is to avoid entanglement with religion, why can't it distinguish between denominations based on the level of entanglement that any particular denomination's polity would create?
Well, so I don't think that first of all, I think that would be very hard to actually do in practice, because you'd have to predict all of the different kinds of entanglement that might happen. And frankly, there was a lot of, they were kind of being a little rough on my opponent at counsel, because he did at one point say, well, if they say repent when they give you the aid, like, or the soup at the soup kitchen, then you would qualify to not be. And that kind of got Justice Gorsuch going a little bit against him. I think that the answer is that it's inherently much more entangling to try to like slice it up by denomination and figure out in advance what is going to be more entangling or not. Instead, don't try to do it on theological bases. Don't do it on denominational bases. Just, think about whether they're religious and sincere. That's a lot better, cleaner way that works in the lower courts.
And I guess we're sort of coming a little bit to the conclusion here, but are there lower court decisions that you're watching that you think this case will be key in, that, you're waiting to, see what the Supreme Court does that might impact some lower court decisions as well?
Actually, there's one interesting one at the Texas Supreme Court where they mentioned at oral argument the fact that this case had been granted, and they were kind of interested to see what would happen with it, which is a case involving the United Methodist Church and Southern Methodist University, which, Southern Methodist University essentially declared independence from the United Methodist Church. And so the United Methodist Church sued and said, well, all our corporate documents say that you're like forever bound to this denomination, so you don't really get to sort of unilaterally declare independence. And so it was very interesting. We filed an amicus brief and a sort of follow-up letter at the Texas Supreme Court in that case. But this case came up in that. So I could see if the court reached a sort of church autonomy issue in this case, it could bring up it could end up having an impact on that SMU case.
Any last words on the case or the argument or impressions that you have?
Oh, I think it was great. I think it was, you know, our system is really, you know, set up well to have like really have out these discussions at the Supreme Court. I mean, it's just amazing how you take years of litigation and kind of distill it into an argument that lasts a little over an hour and a half. But it really does happen. And I think it's really a credit to our system. And I think that I'm hopeful that we'll get a result here that will sort of reaffirm American religious pluralism and, you know, reaffirm our protection for everybody. So.
All right. Well, Eric, thank you. And I don't see any other questions on the plate. So we'll I think we can go ahead and conclude. And thanks for taking time with everyone today.
Thank you.
And thank you both for the fantastic discussion and the benefit of your time and expertise today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. For information on more upcoming events, please visit our website or all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we're adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.